Well, it's a pleasure to welcome James Rickards, his debut on Gold Seek Radio. Financial expert, best-selling author. Really, there's no way for me to do justice to this remarkable CV. Welcome to the show, James Rickards.
Great to be with you, Chris. Thanks for inviting me.
In your extensive writing, I mean, clearly you see an economic collapse on the horizon. And that really echoes the sentiments of so many here on Gold Seek Radio, many of our guests. You're talking about not $1 trillion, not $100 trillion, but a quadrillion. These are numbers that most people just can't wrap their minds around the notional value of our derivatives worldwide. Give us an idea of how this might destabilize things.
The way I look at things, Chris, we all have analytic methods, and mine are non-traditional, meaning they're not the models that central bankers use. They're not the models that Wall Street, most of the people hired at the big firms, so, you know, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Citibank, and others. The reason you get hired to do economic research at one of those firms is because you used to work at the Fed. So they sort of poach, you know, people from the Monetary Economics Department at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York or the Federal Reserve Board in Washington to come do Wall Street research. So looking at Wall Street research is the same as looking at Fed research. Very badly flawed. I mean, smart people, don't get me wrong, they're smart people, they mean well, but they've got obsolete models. My models, the way I go about analyzing it, are techniques that disciplines, really scientific disciplines I've taken from physics, applied mathematics, and elsewhere. They work extremely well in capital markets. They're a much better reflection of the reality. So one of the things I look at is called complexity theory. It's a very well-established branch of science, as I say, not used in economic research, but I use it with very good results. So complexity theory teaches us a couple things. One is when you increase the scale or the size of a system, you don't increase the risk in a linear way. You increase it exponentially. What that means is, so if you double the system, and let's say I doubled the system, and I said to you, Chris, how much did the risk go up? Well, let's just say I asked Jamie Dimon, our friend, the CEO of J.P. Morgan. So I asked Jamie Dimon, I said, Jamie, I doubled the system. How much did the risk go up? And he would say, well, you know, it's long, short, long, short, long, short. Everything pairs off. It nets out, gets close to zero. So the risk only went up a little tiny bit. If I ask my mother's great, 87-year-old lady, very smart, but not an economist, I say, Mom, I doubled the system, how much did the risk go up? She'd probably use intuition and say, the risk doubled, you know, double the system, you double the risk. They're both wrong. Jamie Dimon and my mother would both be wrong, although my mother would be a little bit closer. The correct answer is if you double the system, you increase the risk by a factor of 10 or 100. In other words, it goes up in a nonlinear exponential way. And so when I look at the financial collapse in 1998, that involved a default by Russia at the time and the hedge fund long-term capital management. By the way, I negotiated the bailout of long-term capital management. I was their chief lawyer, so I had a front row seat on that one. I saw behind the scenes exactly how that worked, and we had government officials and bank CEOs and hundreds of lawyers and, you know, open conference calls. I mean, that came very close to taking down the entire global financial system. Unless you were there, people have no idea how close we came to a complete collapse at that time, 1998. Same thing was true in 2008, except it was bigger. You know, in 1998, Wall Street got together to bail out a hedge fund. In 2008, the central banks got together to bail out Wall Street. My question is, in 2018, or tomorrow, or a year from now, it could be any time, who's going to bail out the central banks? In other words, each crisis gets bigger than the one before. Each bailout gets bigger than the one before. We're now at the point where a new crisis, which could erupt at any minute, is bigger than the ability of central banks to bail it out. There's a reason for that. The reason is, two reasons. The central banks are out of ammunition. So the Federal Reserve, took their balance sheet from $800 billion before the 2008 crisis to over $4 trillion today. But the problem is they never normalized it. They never got back down to, you know, they don't have to get down to $800 billion, but if they got down to, you know, $1.5 trillion, I'd say, nice job, guys. You saved the world and you got normalized again. But they never normalized. Same thing with interest rates. They took interest rates all the way to zero, held them there for 6 years. Okay, they're back up to 1%. But you really need to be 3 or 4% in order to cut rates enough to save the system, and they're not. They can't get there. So they bailed it out the last time, but they haven't normalized. And so if a new crisis came tomorrow, which it could, a lot of reasons for that, you can't run the same playbook. You can't cut interest rates when you're this low. You can't increase the balance sheet when you're this high. The same thing is true of all the central banks in the world, European Central Bank, People's Bank of China, Bank of Japan, Bank of England, the Federal Reserve. They're all in the same condition. So now we've got a couple things going on. Number one, we've increased the system, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, Chris. The total amount of derivatives is higher. Bank balance sheets are larger. The percentage of banking assets owned by the five largest banks is greater. Everything that was too big to fail in 2008 is bigger, more densely connected today. So complexity theory teaches us that the risk is going up exponentially. And then when we look at who's going to solve the problem, the central banks are out of ammo. So what's going to happen? Well, there's only one solution. There's only one source of liquidity left in the world. That's the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. They've got to go to this world money. It has a funny name. It's called the Special Drawing Right, or SDR. But it's, you know, people will try to make it sound complicated, but it's actually not that complicated. So the Federal Reserve prints dollars. The European Central Bank prints euros. Well, the IMF can print money, too, and they call it the SDR. I call it world money because that's what it is. So they'll just print these SDRs by the trillions, hand them out to all the member nations, and then they'll go from there. But that will be very inflationary, very bullish, obviously, for the price of gold. People will be going to gold as a safe haven anyway and bidding up the price. But then when you flood the world with this new kind of world money liquidity, that will have an inflationary impact, which will take the dollar price of gold up even higher. So here we are, you know, right now, look, volatility's low, stock markets are hitting new all-time highs every day, it's all good. You look around, you say, where's the risk? It's there. It's buried on these bank balance sheets. It's buried in these new clearinghouses that have been created. It's buried in the extent to which, you know, a small number of banks, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Citi, and a couple others have consolidated all the assets. But when it hits, and it could hit tomorrow, there's no way of knowing exactly when it will, but you can certainly see it coming. These things happen every 7-10 years. It's been, you know, over 8 years since the last one, so no one should be surprised if it hits tomorrow. It'll hit hard. Markets will go down fast. The bailout will come from the IMF, and we'll be living in a whole new world.
You talk about chaotic systems, and complexity comes to mind. Just what will send this chaotic system to the tipping point? And I think that's what you're leading to. In Road to Ruin, you point out that there could be money riots, that banks could, you know, shut their doors, as well as stock exchanges. We saw that, as you pointed to, in 2008, and I think we're seeing some signs in the, you know, nations, Venezuela, obviously, and then, of course, in India with currency issues. This seems to be coming to a head.
Chris, those are sort of predictable consequences or outcomes, meaning they'll shut banks, they'll close ATMs, or they'll reprogram the ATMs so you can only get maybe $200 a day for gas and groceries. That's until they run out of cash. This is actually happening. This is not hypothetical. It happened in Cyprus. It happened in Greece. It's happening now as we speak in Venezuela. Talk to people in Catalonia. I mean, Catalonia was shut down over the past few days because of their independence referendum and the response of the Spanish government. So this is happening all over the world in different pockets. There's no reason to believe that, you know, the United States or Canada or Western Europe are immune, because they're absolutely not. And again, India, you go to bed at night, you wake up, and you find out that the two most popular forms of money are illegal. That's what happened in India. They had a 1,000 rupee note and a 2,000 rupee note, roughly equivalent to maybe a $10 bill and a $20 bill that you might have in your wallet. You wake up and they said, no, it's illegal. They say, you can bring it down to the bank and hand it in, and we'll give you a digital credit in your account. Meanwhile, if you have a stack of them, the tax inspector is saying, where'd you get the money? And even if it's totally legitimate. Okay, one of the interesting things that came out of it, the government justified it by saying, you know, all these people dealing in cash are tax evaders, and we're going to force them to come down and, you know, hand them the money. The tax inspector will be waiting there. Well, they did that. It turns out that tax evasion was minuscule, that actually the overwhelming majority of the transactions were totally legitimate. They were small business people, retailers, fishermen, farmers, who just dealt in cash. They didn't, the smartphones or the bank accounts or the debit cards or the credit cards that we all have. And the whole thing was about nothing because they didn't get any tax evaders, or very, very few, because there weren't any. So it just shows how government, you know, is kind of at war with their own people. But all those things are the consequences of a financial crisis. But your question, Chris, is what would cause it? And I make the point that it doesn't matter. When I say that, I'm not being glib. I'm just saying it could be anything. And the metaphor that I use, but it's not really a metaphor because the science is the same. The mathematics and the dynamics are the same, is what I call the snowflake and the avalanche. So it's snowing, you're in a mountain, it's snowing, and the snow's building up, it's building up, and anyone can look at it, a seasoned mountaineer expert can look at that and say, you know, that snowpack is completely unstable. It's going to fall loose, it's going to come crashing down, it's going to do a lot of damage below. So one day a snowflake comes along and it lands a certain way and it disturbs a couple other snowflakes, gather a little momentum and affects more snowflakes and creates a chute and creates a slide. The momentum rips the snowpack loose and the whole avalanche comes down and buries the village. Who do you blame? Do you blame the snowflake or do you blame the instability of the snowpack, of the snow on the mountain itself? Clearly it's the systemic instability that's at fault, because if it wasn't one snowflake, it would be another. If it wasn't yesterday or today, it would be tomorrow. In other words, I actually once saw a sign in a bar that said, no snowflake ever feels responsible for the avalanche. That's true sort of physically and dynamically. So my point is, when you have an unstable system, something will cause it to collapse. You might not even know. It might just start and all of a sudden there's a panic and people are lined up at the banks and central banks are out of ammo and they're turning to the IMF. And all these things that we talk about play out. And you're like, gee, what started that? Well, it could be, you know, it could be a failure to deliver gold. I mean, you know that the gold system is heavily, heavily leveraged. There's, you know, barely one bar of gold for every 100 bars of paper gold sold, whether it's futures contracts, forward contracts, options, ETFs. There are all kinds of paper gold contracts. But the amount of physical gold backing up, probably about 1%. Well, that's fine as long as nobody wants their gold. But what if people holding, you know, gold forward contracts from the London Bullion Market Association banks call up the bank and say, you know what, I'd like to take physical delivery, please. Here are my instructions. My armored car will show up tomorrow. Take it over to Loomis or Brinks, my private vault. I want to get it out of the banking system. If one guy does it, maybe that's fine. But if more than a handful do it, they don't have the gold. They don't. This isn't some deep, dark conspiracy theory. This is very well known. If you read the fine prints in the contracts, and I'm a lawyer and I have read these contracts, believe it or not, this is very apparent. I've heard horror stories about banks taking a month to deliver to customers who wanted their gold because they couldn't source the gold, at least not very easily, and it took a long period of time. So if you get into that mode, and then what's going to happen then is that the banks are not even going to try. There's always fine print in the contracts. You know, whether it's a force majeure clause or an early termination notice or, you know, material adverse change notice. These are all technical terms for contract, you know, fine print in the contracts. They'll just send you a notice saying, hey, we terminated you as of the close of business yesterday. Here's a check, you know, for your profit. And you're like, but wait a second. I don't want yesterday's price. I want today's price. I want tomorrow's price. You know, gold is screaming. It's going to the moon. That's why I bought the gold. And they'll say, sorry, you didn't buy gold. You had a contract. And we're terminating your contract and sending you a check. And, you know, good luck to you. So that's what will happen. That's the kind of thing that, once it gets publicized, could lead to a panic. But there are many, many other events. Could be geopolitical. Could be a natural disaster. We've certainly seen a run of them lately since the solar eclipse with the three hurricanes, Irma, Harvey, and Maria, and the earthquakes in Mexico, and war with North Korea. I mean, for some reason, the market is sloughing all this off, but I doubt that will last. The panic could start at any time for any reason.
No, exactly. I mean, just as Nassim Taleb refers to anti-fragility and fragility within the markets. And we learn this, you know, I mean, as we study statistics, we don't have the stability of the normal bell curve. We're looking at kurtotic fat tails. And that's the type of environment that you're leading up to here, that eventually there will be chaos. It may be economic. It may be political. It may be both. But I'd like to kind of circle back to this idea you brought up of, is the gold there, or are there too many intermediaries between folks who believe they've procured a large sum of the yellow metal, the implications of what that might mean? Because people are supposed to have, traditionally, 10 to 20% gold and silver in their portfolios. Today, we think that number is less than 1%.
I always recommend 10% gold, I think, but physical gold, not paper gold, and put it in safe non-bank storage. And if you have 10% gold, that's your insurance policy. So if nothing bad happens and gold just kind of, you know, chugs along, goes sideways, you know, with 10%, that's not a big cost, or you're not getting hurt by that. But if everything falls apart, as I do expect, and stocks are crashing and bonds are crashing and other parts of your portfolio are going down, gold will go up by not, you know, 10% or 20%. It'll go up by a factor of 100 or 200 or 300% or more, eventually getting to the $10,000 per ounce level, which is still my intermediate term forecast. And it's not a number I pull out of a hat or a number I, you know, mention to attract attention. It's actually the implied non-deflationary price of gold in a system where confidence in the dollar is being eroded, and you need to go to gold either as a strict gold standard or as a reference point to restore confidence in the dollar. That's where gold would get to. Well, with that kind of price movement, it's basically insuring your other losses. You're losing money over here, but you're making so much on the gold side that your portfolio is relatively stable. That's the insurance role of gold and the stabilizing of gold. And that's why you should have it. Now, some people want more, and clients who have 50%, and I say, well, you know, that's not my recommendation, but if that's your comfort level, then that's fine. That's up to you. But you're right. The institutional allocation is about 1.5%. So if you took all the, you know, the mutual funds and the hedge funds and the institutions and the pension funds, you know, in the world, sovereign wealth funds, they have about 1.5% in gold. That's very lumpy. What you'll find there is, like, most people have zero, and then some people maybe have a 5% allocation, averages out to about 1.5%. But it's completely inadequate for the purpose I described. And what will happen, of course, is that even if that moved modestly, let's just say that the institutional world moved from 1.5% to 3%, you know, not 5 or not 10 or 20, but just 3%, there's not enough gold in the world at these prices to satisfy that kind of incremental demand. So this is one of these binary things where it'll chug along and not do much and things won't change. And then suddenly, there'll be what physicists call a phase transition, or maybe the more popular term is a tipping point. But whatever it is, or however you describe it, it's certain to come, and then you're going to see these extreme price movements simply because there's not enough gold. Now, as far as, you know, when you say, is the gold there? I mean, I talk to people all the time, and they say, well, there's no gold in Fort Knox. There's no evidence to support that view. The gold is there, but it is very likely to be. And people don't understand leasing. They think, you know, if J.P. Morgan leases gold from the U.S. Treasury through the Bank for International Settlements of Basel, Switzerland, that they somehow back up a truck and drive the gold away. That's not true. The gold just sits there. The lease is a paper transaction, but it does give J.P. Morgan a title to gold, which they can rehypothecate. That just means they can sell it again. And they do, and they use these London Bullion Market Association forward contracts, unallocated forward. Unallocated is the key word. That means you're buying gold, but there's no specific bar or serial number with your name on it. You're not actually getting any particular gold. You're just getting a gold contract. Now, there is a provision to convert that to physical gold and say, hey, I'm sending my armored car over and pick it up and I'm taking it over to Brinks. But that's where, you know, like if one guy does it, fine. But if more than a handful do it, there's not enough gold, they're going to terminate all those contracts. And in that situation, by the way, the exposed party is not the U.S. Treasury, it's the bank. So if I'm the Treasury and I have the physical gold and I lease it to you and you sell it 100 times over, so I leased a ton to you and you sell 100 tons, so who's short? It's not me, it's you. Meaning if 20 people show up and say, give me my ton of gold, and you only have one ton, and you don't even have that because it's leased from me, you're the one who's short. And so the banks will be in trouble, not the Treasury. The gold is in Fort Knox. You know, we're actually, only half of it's in Fort Knox. The other half is up at West Point because there's another vault there and a mint. But the point is, you know, you don't have to imagine that the gold's not in Fort Knox. All you have to understand is that through paper transactions, it can be leveraged 100 times over. So I agree that there's hyper-leverage. I agree that there's price manipulation. By the way, the most likely suspect for manipulation is not the Federal Reserve. It's China, because China's still out to buy several thousand tons of gold to catch up with the United States. If you were out to buy 3,000 tons of gold, it's a lot of gold, by the way, as you know. If you were out to buy 3,000 tons of gold in the next 2 years, would you want high prices or low prices? You'd want low prices because you're a buyer. Now, ultimately, the price is going to skyrocket, but you don't want the price to go to $5,000 an ounce today. You want it to stay where it is so you can buy it. Now, eventually, like I say, once you have enough gold and we flip the switch and go to either a gold-backed system, or we're going to run the dollar off the road, or we're going to have a financial war and attack the dollar. That's when the price of gold, you know, skyrockets. But you don't want that right now. So, you know, and there's no way the government, U.S. government, the CFTC, they're not going to investigate China. If China's the manipulator, they can't touch them. It's a sovereign power. You've got diplomatic considerations. You've got geopolitical considerations. The CFTC, you know, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, that has regulatory authority over gold futures trading, they can barely do their job with the normal hedge fund, you know, manipulators. How are they going to go after China? And the answer is they're not. Kind of shrug it off. I'm like, hey, if you want to keep the price low, I'm fine with that. I'll just buy more, you know, and I'll be along for the ride. Just do what China does.
Good advice. All right, looking to ICE 9, you call it. This is lockdown confiscation, of course, borrowed from Kurt Vonnegut in the 60s, Cat's Cradle. What an interesting idea where a certain type of molecule, water molecule, freezes at room temperature, or close to room temperature at least. Just a little added to a stream leads to the river, to the ocean, and before you know it, the world freezes up. You draw, I think, an interesting parallel with this sci-fi concept and our financial system.
Well, it's interesting, and you're right. I have to give credit to Kurt Vonnegut. He invented the term ICE 9, and it was a doomsday machine in his novel. It was invented by a physicist who created this molecule, and he put it in vials, three vials, and gave them to his three children. And then the plot of the novel, by the way, I highly recommend it, Cat's Cradle. It's hilarious. It's a dark, comedic novel. It's a doomsday machine, but it's pretty funny. The plot is, you know, would any of the kids open the vial and pour the ICE 9 into water? Because the minute you do that, the molecule of ICE 9 comes in contact with water. The water turns to ice, and then the next molecule, and it spreads exponentially, and eventually all the streams, rivers, lakes, oceans in the world turn to ice, and life on Earth dies, and that's that. So I took that over into the financial world as a metaphor, but for the same phenomenon. So let's say there's a financial panic. What's the first thing everybody does? They call their money market funds, and they call the brokers, say, sell my shares, put the money in the bank. Tomorrow I want the money in the bank. Get me out of the money market fund. Well, in 2008, that happened, and there was an enormous drain on the money market funds, and the money market funds couldn't keep up. Because what was happening was the money market funds took your money and they invested in commercial paper from European banks, because European banks needed dollar liabilities to fund dollar assets because they were making dollar loans. And remember, the European Central Bank is there to bail out the European banks, but they print euros, they don't print dollars. And so when the European banks needed dollars, they got them by issuing short-term paper to the money market funds. Well, then the money market funds couldn't roll over the paper. The European banks were going bankrupt. The Federal Reserve did a $10 trillion currency swap where we took euros from the European Central Bank and gave them dollars so they could all connect it. But the point is there was no way to stop the run on the banks. So finally, the Federal Reserve guaranteed every money market fund in the world. Well, in the United States, rather. They guaranteed every money market fund. That's how extreme the length they had to go to. But the legal reason for it, one reason, was that the money market funds had no ability to say no to their customers. They had to give them the money, and so they had to get it from the Fed, or they had to cover it with a guarantee. Now, today, that has changed. The law has changed. It's in the time period since 2008. The SEC changed the regulations, so now money market funds can suspend redemptions. By the way, hedge funds have always had this. We had a 500 hedge fund offering documents. They all have a suspension clause in them. So now, in the next panic, when you call your money market fund and say, give me my money, they can suspend redemptions. They can say no, and that's legal. So what are people going to do then? Well, they'll sell stocks because they want the cash. Well, then they'll have to close the stock exchange. And then they'll sell bonds, and they'll have to shut down the bond market. And then, you know, and so on. And so the ICE 9 metaphor is that one by one, every freeze in a particular aspect of the financial system leads quickly to another freeze in another aspect, another facet of the financial system, because the demand for liquidity keeps migrating. Well, gee, if I can't get the money market, I'll take it out of the bank. If you shut the bank, I'll sell my stocks. If you shut the stock exchange, you know, I'll sell my bonds. You know, you shut the bond market, I'll sell my real estate. So, and it'll keep going. I'll have to shut down the entire system. They'll say it's temporary. It won't be, but they'll say that. We'll get back to normal here. Just give us a couple of days to figure it out. And then what you'll find is some of these freezes are permanent. Some of them are converted into forms of property you don't want. The illiquidity spreads. Then they'll have to bail it out with special drawing rights, on and on and on. But that is how it will play out. It can't play out any other way because there are no other tools available. The central banks, as I mentioned, are tapped out. They'll try guarantees, but, you know, if I think the government's going bankrupt and you offer me a guarantee, why do I have confidence in the guarantee? The only thing that's really going to work in that world is gold. But at that point, you won't be able to get it. I tell people, get your gold today while you can at reasonable prices and put it in a safe place. Because in the panic, everyone's going to run out and get gold. What they're going to find out is, you know, the dealers are out of inventory, the mint is backordered, they're not taking your phone call, if they don't already know you, et cetera. You're not going to be able to get the gold. You'll be watching the price go up. You know, you'll have CNBC on the TV, and it'll be going up, you know, $2,000 an ounce, $3,000 an ounce, $4,000 an ounce, and you'll be screaming, get me some gold, but you won't be able to get it. It'll just be in too short supply. So the time to get it is now.
And as we wrap up here today, predictive analytic technology, mitigating market risk with complexity science. I want people to wrap their minds around the idea of IBM's Watson. Many folks will remember the Jeopardy show, you know, between the brightest human players and IBM's Watson and the amazing performance that Watson gave. Well, you all are incorporating Watson's and IBM's technology into your platform.
I'm working with a team. It's a company I started about a year ago. We have a fabulous CEO, Kevin Massengill, a former Army Ranger, achieved the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, intelligence background, but also great entrepreneurial skills, great CEO, fabulous Chief Scientist, Terry Rickard, same last name as me without the S. But anyway, we put this team together. We've started a company. We're partnering up with IBM's Idea Lab and their Watson supercomputer to take some of the things that we're talking about on this call, Chris, complexity theory and also other branches of science, behavioral psychology, applied mathematics, something called Bayes' theorem, and history, and putting it into a cognitive network that actually has very powerful predictive abilities. A lot of math and science behind it, but we're basically abandoning all the models and all the math and all the assumptions that do not work, and we know it doesn't work because we have the data. So, you know, efficient markets and normally distributed risk, what you talked about earlier, the bell curve, all that stuff is all junk science. We're leaving that behind. We're finding using science that does work, putting it into an application that will be available to large institutional investors with very good results. So we're having fun with it. It's called Meraglim, M-E-R-A-G-L-I-M, meraglim.com. People want to go have a look at our website. There are, opportunities to look at a private placement for accredited investors. We're excited about it, getting very good results, and looking forward to rolling out the product.
The more I read about this idea, the more intriguing it becomes. I mean, my background, actuarial sciences, ties in with the Bayesian analysis that you're employing within the system. Do you care to talk at all about binomial Bayesian analysis and just how you're using conditional inference in mathematics to improve the forecasts and predictions of this interesting model?
Bayes' rule is, it's an applied mathematics formula. It was invented by or discovered by Thomas Bayes, who was actually a Presbyterian minister in England in the late 18th century. So it's been around for over 200 years, but it has not been used on Wall Street. It has been used in many other applications. I first encountered it working for the CIA doing counterterrorism after 9/11. We used it all the time. So I got familiar with the mathematics and the application of it, but all we've done, we didn't invent the science, but we've taken the science and brought it over into capital markets. And Bayes' rule is something that you use when you're trying to solve a critical problem, but you don't have enough information. I always say, well, if you had all the information, a high school kid could solve the problem, but how do you solve life and death problems, or in the case of Wall Street, critical problems regarding your portfolio and your net worth and market behavior? How do you solve those problems on partial and complete information? The way you do it is with Bayes' rule, and it basically involves forming a hypothesis with whatever information you have. Is to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, it's what we say at the CIA, you go to war with the data you have, but then you update. You say, as new data comes in, you update on using conditional probabilities. How likely is it that the subsequent thing would or would not have happened if my original hypothesis was true? And then you can strengthen or weaken the original hypothesis to lead to an updated view, and then when it gathers enough strength, gets up to the 70, 80, 90% level, then you can make a prediction with a lot more confidence than when you started. So it's one of many fields that we use, not new science, but new application, bringing it into capital markets where it works extremely well. And Chris, I really, really enjoyed this interview. I really enjoyed the opportunity to talk to you, and I hope I can come on the program again sometime.
Oh, no, you're absolutely welcome on the show. We would be delighted to have you. I know the listeners will be excited to have heard from James Rickards today. Cannot wait to see how this private placement works out. So I know many of our listeners will certainly check out the links and want to find out more. James Rickards, any other contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners?
Well, I'm very active on Twitter. My handle is at James G. Rickards. Use my middle initial G, last name R-I-C-K-A-R-D-S. So at James G. Rickards. I have a newsletter, Strategic Intelligence, published by Agora Financial. It's easy to find on the web. Just look for, go to the Agora Financial website, look for Strategic Intelligence. My most recent book, The Road to Ruin. So I hope listeners and readers enjoy it.
Very good. We'll hopefully talk again soon.
Thank you, Chris.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%. totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.